Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you like, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm delighted now to welcome Frieda Arth. She is the president of the board of the New Mexico Women's Foundation, and she will be giving a talk called Continuing the Journey on Wednesday, that's tomorrow, October 13th at 5:30 in the afternoon. It's one of the key presentations this year by Women's Voices. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
So you've gotten involved with working with refugees in recent years. Just to start off with, what do we mean when we talk about refugees? It's not the same as other kinds of immigration to the United States.
That's true. A refugee is somebody who, because of war or because of other ghastly things happening in their country, are trying to escape persecution of some kind, and they will flee their country. Mostly, when they flee, they walk, and they're walking through forests, and they're walking to another country. And they're trying to get to some sort of safety. Often when they get to the other place, they will discover that that other place doesn't want them either, and they keep walking. So it could they could end up being two countries away or a number of countries away from the village where they lived, and for various reasons. For example, some people are subject to ethnic cleansing. Some people are the people you hear about.
I just
about.
Have to say, ethnic cleansing, it's such an awful euphemism, and yet we use it. It's basically genocide based on ethnicity.
It is. It is. It means you've really lost your nationality. You've lost your culture in that country, and you are expected to leave. You're no longer wanted. And so when things get really tough, like we're going to put you in prison, or we're going to kill you, or we're going to rape you, or something like that, then the people have no choice but to try to find some sort of safety. And they end up then, if they're lucky, they end up in a place where somebody says, well, we're going to put you in a refugee camp, or we're going to create a refugee camp. And refugee camps sound like, well, we're all going camping and there'll be 20 of us. But, you know, refugee camps are have as many as 200,000 people in them. And I'm working with some people right now, and they came from a camp of 9,000 people. So it's startling. These are startling statistics that we're not quite used to talking about here.
Some of the countries from which we have refugees in Albuquerque, I mean, traditionally it's been people from Cuba and Vietnam, I guess. Mm-hmm. Now there's people from a lot more countries.
I actually only got involved with working with refugees and in particular refugee women about a year ago in Albuquerque, because New Mexico Women's Foundation was doing a special project, a collective, to help women learn how to set up cottage industries. And one day the doors opened and here came women from about 10 different countries in Africa, Bhutan, Nepal, Iraq, and it was just a total surprise to me. I come from Washington, D.C. before I moved to Santa Fe. That's where I lived, and I thought I knew all about this sort of thing, but I wasn't prepared for meeting all these wonderful women who had, when I say recent, had just gotten here maybe 2 months before or 3 months before, and they were trying to navigate a whole new culture, a whole new way of doing things, and terrified that they were going to do something wrong.
What were some of the stories that you heard from these women about why they had to leave their countries? Obviously, nobody wants to leave their country and their homeland unless things are really awful.
Now, this one family in particular, who are Bhutanese, they tried to get to India. They were part of the south part of Bhutan became the major ethnic cleansing area when the royal family decreed that everybody had to speak one language and wear the same kind of clothes, and those were not what this family did. The Hindu people in the southern part of Bhutan were the ones that were being chased out and harassed and killed. So they had to get across the border in the middle of the night with just, you know, nothing, no, just the clothes on their back. Got to India, got turned back, kept going, and then ended up in under the guidance of some people who put them in a camp in Nepal. This particular family spent 17 years until just a few months ago in a refugee camp in Nepal. And what was so interesting about Bhutan is that two friends of mine had recently gone there on vacation and came back just saying the most glowing things about that country. It's the country of happiness. That's the national constitution, blah, blah, blah. And we had no idea that things were so terrible.
It's funny, when you read about the conditions that refugees are escaping, and they're from countries where precisely that. There's just a culture of, sometimes it's a Buddhist or a Hindu culture or really any religious culture which has true love and peace and tolerance built into it. You see the incredible brainwashing power of militarism to take that culture and destroy it in the subculture of soldiers.
Yeah.
To turn against their own people.
Yeah. And this family I'm speaking about, they were farmers. You know, they had farming as a business, and then they had their personal farm, and a delightful family. And I'm sure never dreamed that anything like this was going to happen. But they were just, you know, a few of the people who came from countries like Burundi, Liberia, Rwanda, Republic of Congo, Nigeria, Sierra Leone, Somalia, beautiful, beautiful women, and often would be bringing children, you know, all the past months and trying to learn how to do something in order to try to make a living. The mandate when they get on a plane, when they finally are accepted to go to any country, and everybody doesn't come to America. They go to many different countries.
Well, we have a much lower quota for refugees, I think, than a lot of other Western democracies, don't we?
From what I've read, we do. I'm not certain about that, but I think we do. It's a pretty low quota. But when a refugee is coming, the mandate that they get on the plane with is, at the end of three months, you'd better know English. At the end of 6 months, you have to have a job. You're cut off from everything. You don't get any more money. You're going to be paying for your own apartment. You're going to be taking care of yourself. And it's a really difficult time for them. But they're the most hardworking people I've ever seen.
Yeah. Imagine it the other way around. You put you or me in Rwanda, say, learn the native language in 3 months and have a job somehow competing with the native people who already know everything in 6 months.
I know. It's pretty gross.
It's daunting, and yet people do it.
Yeah. Well, some do, and some really have a hard time with it. And they are terrified if they do something wrong, they're going to be sent back.
Let's follow that. So people have to leave their countries. They leave on foot. They usually end up in refugee camps. Most of them don't leave. Some percentage of them do. They get on a plane. They fly to a new country. What happens when they land?
Well, they are assigned. Every state has a resettlement agency, and so they are assigned a case manager from that resettlement agency. In New Mexico, and I believe in Texas and probably some other states, it's Catholic Charities. They have the contract with the U.S. government to take care of X number of refugees, and they have some sort of system for helping determine how many, you know, an area can take. A lot of people are probably familiar with the book and the film called Lost Boys of the Sudan. And there are about three other books out right now that give some pretty graphic and disturbing information about how difficult it is when refugees get here.
So they're assigned to a case manager, and are they given a place to sleep and some food to eat at the beginning?
They're given, yeah, they're put into an apartment. They usually come off the plane very sick, very ill. They're
because of malnourishment in the camp?
Well, and also because of different kinds of food that they've been given since they got on. maybe 2 days of flying through different countries before they get here. It's not unusual for somebody to be flying 2 days. And they get off the plane, they don't feel well. Somebody meets them there and takes them to an apartment, and they've been living in a hut on dirt. They don't know that you can't turn the stove flame on, that you might burn the place down, that you don't put live chickens in the freezer, and, you know, all sorts of things. So it's a lot of education. The education process is huge.
Are there volunteers besides the case managers? Are there people who enjoy working with folks and helping them with stuff like that?
You know, most of their volunteers come from churches.
Interesting.
And so they may be Buddhist, they may be Hindu, they may be whatever, other kind of religion. But they will adopt another religion because people help them from those churches. And I think that's where they get the most help, really. They're sort of enveloped, you know, and they don't lose track of their own religion. They're just like, okay, I'm Hindu and Baptist.
Right.
So it's pretty funny.
It's interesting. There are a lot of people who have that kind of flexibility, like the more religions, the better. Two is okay.
Yeah, I was talking to one of the men refugees the other day, and he was taking his turn painting the walls down at the church, just like everybody else. And he really thought that was cool. And, of course, I think it's cool, too.
Now, how did you get involved with the refugees in Albuquerque?
New Mexico Women's Foundation had a special project for a year called Village Design Collective. We, as you already know, we help women set up cottage industries. And we're a statewide organization, so this is something we do throughout the state. And that just seemed like another little state to us, or another village in Albuquerque. And we open our doors, and all women are welcome. We don't ask their age. We don't ask how much money they have, or how little, or where they're from, or anything, unless they want to tell us. And
now, so probably our regular listeners know you and your voice because of the Rag Rogue Festival, which happens every year. And I think we've had you on for 6 years in a row. How long have you been doing it?
Well, that's 7 years.
So. Yeah. And so this is a continuation of that, in the sense that you were teaching the same things you teach to New Mexican women all over the state.
That's correct. And this year in Santa Fe, in August recently, we had a huge booth set up of refugees and their work, the work that they have been doing for the last few months. And they were so excited because they made some money from things that they had created themselves. And it was very emotional. It was quite emotional for them.
At the beginning, when you were talking about people, you said you were talking about people in the villages they came from. Do most of the refugees who land here and whom you've met come from villages as opposed to coming from cities?
The ones that I have met all come from villages. I'm sure that there are people who come from cities. I think probably more of the Iraqis come from cities. And the Iraqi men don't really want the Iraqi women to come to our collective.
Ah.
So, you know, I think they're concerned. They're afraid. And so, but I did have a good turnout of Arabs from other countries. And it was wonderful. It was a joyous occasion every single day.
Yeah. Now, are they bringing some traditional crafts that then are being expanded and taken into the kind of things that the Women's Foundation will then sell in their next festival?
The only craft that I saw that they could be bringing from their past experiences was generally landed in the area of beading or jewelry making. But because they never had any materials, they couldn't keep up doing this. And it is rare that they knew what to do when they got here. They had an idea. Everybody wanted a sewing machine, for example. And I started getting tons of sewing machines donated. But they need more than a sewing machine. I suddenly cut the sewing machines off and I said, wait a second, we need a computer, a microwave, a DVD player, and a TV set. That is how you begin your educational process here when you're living in such terrible places and such terrible circumstances. Their places are not nice when they get here, the ones that they're put in. It's a real ghetto situation, and they're quite dangerous, and the refugees are quite afraid of them.
It's funny because we talk about the evils of television, but I suppose if you're a new immigrant or refugee in the United States, television is a great educational tool.
You know, and it's not, they're not watching television because, you know, now with the change in TV, nobody has that hookup in the buildings
right.
They're in. But what we're able to do is to give them films to watch, and then they come with their own DVDs. Like, they'll get something that somebody has done for them. maybe someone they know or a relative in this who's come to another state, they will send them a DVD, you know. And so that was the beauty of that. It wasn't that they were going to be watching American daytime television or anything, because none of their TVs work like ours did. I mean, there's just not, the buildings don't, what is that called? What did they just do, the HD TV?
Yeah,
or
whatever
something?
It is, digital.
Yeah, well.
You can't get it through the airwaves anymore.
And then, of course, there's the problem of what people give you, and people give you the most awful stuff that doesn't work. So, you know, you have to have this whole volunteer system of getting rid of the stuff that doesn't work at all. I don't know.
What are some of the attitudes that you've encountered on the part of regular people, so to speak, toward refugees? I think a lot of people don't understand.
Right. Almost everybody that I talk to think a refugee is an illegal alien. I mean, that just seems like it's across the board. Even if they don't have a problem with illegal aliens, they just think that all gets lumped together. The most severe thing that I've had happen to me was sitting near a man who was having dinner at the same time I was. When he heard me say that I was working with refugees, he picked up his plate and got up and moved to another place to eat by himself. So I realized what prejudices we have against things that we don't know anything about.
One of the stories that was most telling to me was some years ago I was talking to a man from another country, and he was saying that where he comes from in South America, when he was little, if a new kid came to school, everybody in the class would surround the new kid and say, "What's it like where you're from? Tell us how you eat. Tell us how you dance. What is your music like? What are your people like? What's the geography like?" Yeah. They would pepper the child with questions. And here it seems that, with many wonderful exceptions, we have kind of the opposite attitude mm-hmm. toward people from other places.
Well, a hands-off, a wait-and-see. I'm not quite sure. Is somebody taking something? Are they taking bread from my mouth? You know.
And also, we don't want to know about them. We wait until they assimilate and start doing the things that we do.
That's true in a lot of cases. It is. And it's pretty sad because people are missing out on great experience. I mean, I have learned so much in the past year from people from different countries. It's been a joy.
What are some of the things that you've learned about people from different countries?
Well, I've learned that, particularly the women from Africa, but I guess all the women, I've noticed that they love to get dressed up in costumes from their country. They love to show off. They love to look wonderful, and they're constantly looking for fabrics that they might be able to make, you know, that look like their costumes that they have from their country and things like that. I was surprised, you know, when I go to work in the day, I'll put on jeans or whatever, you know. I never think about getting dressed up. Oh, that's totally opposite with them. You know, jeans they probably wear at home, but when they came to learn how to sew or weave or knit or crochet or something like that, they were always dressed. It's fabulous. I love that. And, you know, I said, we have to have a fashion show one day.
Through the work that they're doing at the New Mexico Women's Foundation that you're assisting with, what kinds of skills are they learning? Are they able yet, so far in your experience, to translate that into actual support of themselves and their families?
Well, mostly they need an everyday job, a job that's going to pay them some kind of wage, an hourly wage. I mean, they really have to have that because you can't turn on your utilities or anything like that. The kind of process that we go through takes a little bit longer because not only are they learning new skills, but they're learning how to navigate the language problem, and they're learning how to use a computer, and you're learning how to figure out how to have some sort of business, because ultimately what we want women to be able to do is to set up their own cottage industries if at all possible, and we know for a fact that eventually that can lead them to be pretty self-sufficient. We try to find things for them to do for which they get paid, and like, I never ask a refugee to do anything that I can't pay them for. Right now I'm teaching two women how to run rag festivals. And so it's pretty exciting. I think that it's not a hard thing for them to do. They can relate to the women. They can relate to women in any language. And I think it's the one thing they learn easily when they come here, like everybody from everywhere, are flea markets. You know, if you go to flea markets because you're looking for a bargain, or you're looking for something that you need, you pretty well can see that when people lay something out on tables to sell and there is the possibility of income, it's not so far-fetched. It's not so different than what we're trying to do with Women's Cottage Industries and the Ragard festivals and so forth.
I would think that it's just psychologically such a sort of crazy mixed situation for them, because on the one hand, they're truly away from the type of persecution that they were facing, rape, genocide, military threats, and so on. On the other hand, they're here in a country which may or may not be that actually friendly to them and where it may be very difficult to survive. So there's a sense of both freedom and non-freedom at the same time.
And they're afraid of making mistakes. They're constantly afraid of making mistakes because, first of all, they're really nice people, and I haven't met any that aren't just absolutely terrific. If they make a mistake, they could, you know, cause you to be concerned, the other person that they're with to be concerned. Or the ultimate thing, of course, would be, and the opposite part of that would be if they made such a big mistake and somebody sent them back somewhere. Because they don't expect ever to be sent back to the same place they came from. They know that people can put you any place they want. And if you've been in a camp for 20 years or even 2 years, you pretty well know that you're a prisoner there. You actually have no rights. You know? That's the real hard part of this.
Now, they do have rights here, presumably as long as they don't commit a felony or something like that, and there is a path to citizenship.
Yes. And it's a pretty easy path, actually. That's the best part of this. Within a few months, they can get a green card. You know, within a few weeks, they can get a Social Security card. They know how important these documents are to them, by the way. Transportation is a huge problem, because if you don't have transportation and you can't drive, you will easily spend 2 hours getting to a job and 2 hours getting home from the job. And that's pretty discouraging. You know? So there are lots of obstacles for them to overcome.
There's also the thing which I think is difficult wherever you travel, under whatever circumstances. The only bureaucracies which we know well are our own.
Right.
So navigating another country's bureaucracies, from everything from the motor vehicles division to rent and tax paying and all those things, is really challenging to
it
do on your own.
It is very challenging. And that's where good volunteers can be so helpful, by taking somebody by the hand and saying, let's go together, you know, and I'll make sure that, you know, everything's going to turn out okay. Case managers certainly can't do it all because there aren't enough of them. And when somebody finds someone to help them, it's a really good marriage. It's a wonderful marriage.
So you are going to be speaking tomorrow night tomorrow afternoon at 5:30 at Collected Works Bookstore. It's part of the Women's Voices presentation. What are you looking for at New Mexico Women's Foundation? How can people listening get involved and help you out and help some of these women out and maybe meet them and so on?
Well, they can meet them. And I'd love to set up little events for people to interact with all the people that we work with. That's very easy. Of course, in Santa Fe, I have plenty of space to do that. In other places, I would just make a place for it. For example, we're going to Farmington next month for our Ragrug Festival up there.
Nice.
And we'll have something special to give information about that. And we'll have a refugee who's going to be my assistant. So that's going to be an exciting thing. All people need to do, if they're really interested in helping refugees, is to call our office, New Mexico Women's Foundation, at 983-6155. And if they want to Google our website, they can see some of the things that we do. That's very, very easy. And there are so many ways to make a difference. And it's just so easy to make a difference.
Do you find that some of these women and their families have post-traumatic stress syndrome and need that kind of mental health help?
That's true in more cases than you can imagine. And the refugees talk about it themselves. They'll say, so-and-so had to go to the hospital, and they're not coming back for another 10 days. You know, they have a nervous breakdown, they have mental depression, blah, blah, blah. They all talk about this. And, yeah, it's a huge problem. It is. And I'm not sure with our current health care situation how a lot of this stuff is going to get resolved, because their only solution is the solution that everybody else uses when they don't know what to do, is to go to an emergency room and turn themselves in and hope that it will be okay. And often it's not okay.
So you are part of Women's Voices.
Well, I've been a supporter of Women's Voices for several years, ever since Charlie Romney Brown started it here, and it's a pretty nifty organization. When she called recently and said, I think you should come and talk about refugees, I'm like, wow, you know, I've got this to do and that to do, and she's like, no, you have to come. After all, Lieutenant Governor Diane Dinesh is coming, and, you know, so-and-so is coming as speakers, doing presentations. So I thought it was really great of her to want to put us on the roster so that we can inform people who don't have any idea that our country is welcoming some refugees and trying to do what it can to help. And I think it's also great that Dorothy Massey's Collected Works bookstore is the location for this, because it's always a pleasure to be in there. And now they have a little cappuccino thingy going on.
Yes, they have a very nice coffee bar and some pastries in there. The Collected Works bookstore at its, I wonder how long I can keep calling it the new location, but it's the new, relatively new location on Galisteo at the corner of Water Street in Santa Fe.
Right, and Women's Voices, if somebody wants to talk to them about this, that telephone number is 424-0884. And talk to Charlie or talk to one of the other women who are involved in their membership program and so forth, because I think it might be of interest to people who don't know about it.
What is the mission of New Mexico Women's Foundation?
We help support organizations and programs that create economic opportunities for New Mexico's women and girls. Our tagline is that we try to help women have a more abundant life. And that sort of says it.
Frieda Arth is the president of the board of the New Mexico Women's Foundation. And once again, tomorrow afternoon at 5:30, she will be at Collected Works Bookstore. It's one of the big presentations of Women's Voices. And Duka Subedi, a refugee Bhutanese woman who spent 17 years in a camp in Nepal, will also be participating in the conversation with Frieda at Collected Works. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
You're so welcome, and I'm so thrilled to be back. Thank you.
We're going to take a little break now. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Colette Feinberg. She is a life and wellness coach, and this is Cancer Awareness Week, and she is a four-time cancer survivor who leads support groups for people with cancer. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Thank you so much.
It's a hard subject to talk about, obviously, because when that diagnosis comes, no matter what kind of cancer it is, and some of them are perceived as a death sentence immediately, and some of them have a very good prognosis, no matter what it is on that spectrum, it's very scary.
It is. The impact is really devastating when it first hits you. You kind of have to pick yourself off the floor and figure out, okay, so what do I do now?
And then making the decisions of what to do now is a journey, and in your case, a very long journey of, over 15 years. And you have chosen a path that included both allopathic medicine, alternative medicine, and then all sorts of other ways of supporting your spirit and heart, so to speak.
Yes, because I feel that it's so important to uplift your spirit along the way as a part of it. I see it as a holistic approach, and I think it's such an important part of the healing in addition to doing the treatments that you've chosen to do for yourself.
So how did you, when this diagnosis came, how did you navigate your way forward? How did you figure out the choices that you wanted to make, and how do you look back on those choices?
I did a lot of research, actually, on the internet. I talked to people. I looked to see what was out there, what was available, what the different options were. And then I think it's so important for each individual to, I for me, it was like checking inside. Does this feel right for me? Is this something that I want to have as a treatment on my body? Can I handle this treatment emotionally, physically, mentally? Because they're all connected. And I had to ask myself that with every choice that I made. And it was very important for me, for myself, to make those choices that were aligned with who I am and my spirit.
And so that included surgery at one point, and then you went to Mexico and did some alternative treatments there.
Yes, I did something called Gerson therapy. It's a very assertive alternative treatment.
What is it?
It's done through all kinds of different IVs, and the doctor is the one who chooses what they are, but they're usually vitamins, minerals, all kinds of supplements, but done in, you know, intravenously. The diet is incredibly strict because as a cancer patient, you have to be very, very mindful about what you put in your body.
So no more spaghetti and meatballs.
Well, that was not an option. And also being careful about, you know, meats because they're carcinogenic. So there's certain, and cancer, by the way, feeds on sugar. And there's many things that turn into sugar, not just sugar itself. So
when you say meat is carcinogenic, you mean when it has nitrites and things like that in it?
Yes, but it's still not part of a cancer diet, at least not any of the ones that I've been involved with. I've been on raw foods. I've been on vegetarian kinds of things because they really feed the body and feed the cells. And again, that's a choice. That's a choice. But I've been to a couple different clinics, two or three clinics, and every one of them has had a specific diet, and none of them included any kind of meat or sugar or carbohydrates or any of those things.
So you're basically on vegetables.
Vegetables, fruit, things like that, yes.
Plants.
Yes, plants, because they're live, and they're live enzymes. And again, they feed the body, and they build the body.
And so that actually worked out for you, but then there were three more recurrences.
Yes, to my surprise, there were. There were. And I just had to make new choices each time. I did go through surgery three times in terms of a lumpectomy, but then I made other choices that would support the body, because if you make choices and you only make choices to do treatments that bring down your immune system, you have nothing to fight with. You have to have an immune system to be able to fight.
Right.
So whatever path you choose, I think it's pretty important to have a holistic approach in your treatments, so you're supporting the body as you go along, having whatever treatments you choose that feel right for you.
So you lead groups, support groups for people who are dealing with cancer in one way or another. What do you do in your groups?
The groups, I basically call them navigating your healing journey, because I see it as a healing journey, and I hold it as wellness. So I'm creating a safe place for women to come and share their stories, for them to share with each other, to give information, to give direction, to share tools for things like balance, setting boundaries, enhancing the quality of your life.
Now, when you say setting boundaries, from your own experience, what does that mean?
One of the things that it means, and I have, of course, had this happen to me, so I had to learn very quickly how to set boundaries, is, you know, your friends and your family love you, and they want to help you in any way they can, except most people don't know how. And so what I found is people would give me all kinds of resources, and I found myself being overwhelmed.
Now, by resources, do you mean unsolicited advice? Oh, you should take this supplement, that
or
kind
you
of thing?
Should, or you should go to this clinic, or you should take this, or this is a great protocol, or lots of people have had success with this. That does not help. it creates a lot of overwhelm and confusion, and I've talked to many cancer patients that have had the same experience. So I had to learn how to say, "Gee, I know you love me, but I really appreciate you caring and sharing things with me, but I have to make the choices for myself of what feels right for me, and what I would love is your love and support and your compassion."
I think it's particularly tricky in a place like Santa Fe, which has a very well-developed holistic and alternative medicine community and a lot of people who are patients in those many systems, who then start thinking they know everything and they want to enlighten you.
Yes. Yes, that's true. But again, they're just trying to let you know that they care about you. And so I've had to say thank you, but I've chosen what I feel is right for me. And I'll keep this in mind, or I'll put this in my library. But all this information it's a little bit too much for me because I'm very fragile right now. I'm saying, as I'm going through these treatments, I'm fragile and I'm vulnerable. And what I really need is support. And if I need something else, I will ask you.
Now, what kind of support is useful in situations like that? Let's say you're the relative or friend of somebody who's had a cancer diagnosis, maybe first time, maybe second or more. What kind of support do they need? What kind of support did you need in those moments?
I needed someone in the very beginning who could do a lot of research. And in this instance, it happened to be, at that time I was married for a long time. And so he knew me well. And he was a research person. And he also knew what my mindset was, what my consciousness was, what was important to me. And so he did a lot of the research for me and then would share things with me, and we would talk about them. Because there's just so many things out there. And I think it's important to choose a protocol and then have support systems around it rather than being all over the place. And any one thing is not for everyone. And I think it's important to honor what each person has chosen for their particular treatments or protocol. That's very important.
And I think because you are emphasizing this intuitive part of it, for some people, for example, in regular life, vegetarianism is very healthy for them, and for other people, it makes them skinny and weak. Mm-hmm. And in the same way, medical treatments, they're not all the same for all people. There is no gold standard that works for everybody.
That's true. There's not.
So beyond the research phase, so you had this wonderful partner who helped you do the research, then you choose a treatment. What kind of support and help do you need during that treatment?
I think being around other people who've gone through it, who understand, because if you haven't walked in those shoes, you can have compassion. It's not the same than having been through it. And also then letting them know exactly what you would like from them so that both people are clear on that piece. And then doing other things besides diet. For me, I would do yoga, and I've been meditating for 30 years, and I have a particular path that I follow that has given me a lot of strength on all levels. And so that I can do what I call kind of hold my center, so that when things are coming at me, I can remain calm inside.
Right.
Keeping your stress level down is incredibly important, and thoughts create stress. So I have many, many tools that help me do that, and that is very, very key for me.
We're talking to Colette Feinberg. She is a life and wellness coach, and she leads support groups for people with cancer. We'll be giving the phone number at the end of this segment. You've talked about acceptance, and acceptance can mean a lot of things. There's acceptance of the disease. There's acceptance of the fact of mortality. What does it mean for you? What do you go through when you're going through that process of learning acceptance?
I think it is a process, and it is a journey. It doesn't happen overnight. And I've had a lot of things to deal with. I mean, fear, for one. I mean, it's huge. I don't know too many people on this planet who just go, oh, yeah, I'm going to die. That's great. I mean, you know, that comes up. So dealing with each thing that comes up and being able to accept yourself the way you are right now and loving yourself, really learning how to love yourself from the inside out, is very, very important, because it's not out there with classes and people and everything else. That's not where the love needs to come from to sustain you. So loving yourself and having trust, not only in yourself, but in your higher power, whatever that may be. And so it's a journey coming to that place of saying, yes, I accept the way that I am right now. And if you can stay present in each moment, fear only lives in the future. So if you can stay in the moment, it's a lot easier, and you're able to stay much more calm and peaceful. And then having different tools, whether it be prayer, you know, meditation, yoga to calm the body, because then it stops the mind. Things like that, that support you in the whole picture.
Was there any moment that was a turning point for you in this whole process of real acceptance and alignment within yourself about having cancer?
I don't think acceptance is a one-time thing. I think there are many levels, and I think that for me, different things come up along the way. It could be fear, it could be anxiety, it could be something that triggers me and gets me stressed out. And being able to accept myself for where I am, instead of thinking I should be different, or I'm not okay if I'm not calm and peaceful about that there's something wrong with me, that's a part of acceptance. Right. And I think it's a journey. And there's different levels of accepting as each of us goes along in life.
Humor and fun have also been part of your journey.
Yes, it does make me laugh when I think about it. I have this wonderful character that I created called Sweet Pea. She's my clown character. And
complete with clown suit and the whole
thing.
Oh,
yes, absolutely. And I never forget this. It was the second bout for me. It was 99. And I was flying for treatment, and I was reading Patch Adams. And I found myself laughing and crying and being inspired, because Patch Adams was also a clown. And it just came to me while I was on the plane that what I needed was to bring laughter into my life, because that's a very important part of the healing process. So after my treatment, I went home. I created a clown character. I had someone make me an incredible costume, and I was very clear what I wanted to do. I wanted to go play with the children in the hospitals in short stay. And I tell you, it just brought everyone, including the nurses, everyone, the kids, myself, it brought so much laughter and so much joy. And I know, you know, we've all heard about watch silly movies, really all those things, because it can be heavy and serious. And I don't want the group, I want the groups to be lighthearted.
So you are teaching a course. We're talking to Colette Feinberg. She's a life and wellness coach, a four-time cancer survivor, and will be teaching a course that goes from the end of October through December. And for more information, people can go to your website, which is thebalancecoach.com, or call 466-2657. And we're here talking in honor of Cancer Awareness Week. I want to thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Mary. You know, I just wanted to say one other thing. I'm trying to make it very, very comfortable and easy for people. So the series will be on the phone, so no one has to go anywhere. They're in the comfort of their own home.
Like a conference
yes,
call with the whole group?
Yes, it's a conference call, and I'm keeping the groups very small, about maybe 10 people. So they could be intimate and authentic. And
they know each other's voices, even if they don't see each other's faces.
Absolutely.
Colette Feinberg, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, and that means that you can hear the show there anytime you like, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and you can always email me as well at radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Colors of Jazz.